The achievement of many of our blind members over the decades. So let's go.
My name is John Deedon. I was born in Denver, Colorado in July of 1961.
Were you born blind?
Yes.
How easy was it for you to find a job?
It wasn't easy at all. And this is where the NFB really had an impact on my life. I was looking for a job and I had graduated and I kept looking and I wasn't finding anything. There was a guy named Brian Johnson. He's from Illinois and he was doing fundraising for the NFB. And he got a hold of my old manager at a brokerage firm. And the guy was so good on the phone, my manager thought, why couldn't a blind person be a stockbroker? He didn't know that there was some stockbrokers already. There was probably, I don't know, 7 or 8 already that were successful. He contacted the local NFB here. And they said, how would you like to come and talk to us about job opportunities to Diane McGeorge, who was our state president at the time? And she said, I'd love to do that. And then she asked me if I would like to go and talk to the president of the firm about a job opportunity. And I said, of course, because I was unemployed, fresh out of college. I went and talked to the guy, and he said, Johnny, if you can pass the test, you got a job here. And so I studied, and I took the Series 7, which is the main brokerage test to become a stockbroker, and I passed it, and then I started working for them. About 2 years later, I had an article in the paper here published about me being the first blind stockbroker in Colorado. And a guy from Sioux City, Iowa, Richard Crawford, who's also in the NFB, read the article. And he called me up and he said, Deedon, how would you like to come to work for a real firm? And I said, yeah, I'd love that. And he got me an interview and he said, the rest is up to you. And I got the job there, and that was like switching from the minor leagues to the major leagues. It was totally different, and I loved it.
And how long were you a stockbroker?
4 years, a little over 4 years. I wasn't that good at it, obviously, or I'd probably still be doing it. And they let me go. So then I was scrambling to try to find another job, and I found a job doing collections on defaulted student loans, and I did that for a couple years. I got pretty tired of doing collections. We called it jacking people up on the phone. So I did that for a couple years. So I started searching. The state had a regulatory body for securities. A job came open, and so I went and I tested for that. I got hired there. That's where I worked for most of my life. I worked 25 years there.
And you're now retired.
Yes, ma'am. And happy to be so. The smile's never left my face.
Judy Modest Dixon. And they've morphed a bit. I started out training developmentally disabled adults to work in jobs around Boulder. And I did some bus training with them. And I did some on-the-job training. And it was really, that was a wonderful job. I was on the ground when we started the Center for People with Disabilities in Boulder. And that back then really focused on independent living and employment. Employment was our number one goal. The Center for People with Disabilities is still here and it's still thriving. I moved from that. I had a short stint at the Division of Rehabilitation doing grant management, federal grant management for 2 years. That was good training. And I worked at the city of Boulder. That's where I started my mediation career, resolving issues with landlords and tenants and public accommodations issues for people of color, people who were disabled, etc. And then I quickly moved to a private mediation firm that is still doing well today. And I was there as an associate and as a partner. And then I established my own firm in 2004. Most of what I've done as a mediator is corporate work in the private sector for the last 20 years, focused on upper management issues. In New Zealand, for example, I actually went there 9 different times over the years, working with different organizations. I worked with their primary building contractors, working with them to resolve some internal disputes. I've also worked with what's called weathertight homes. What happened in New Zealand is they built many, many homes in the, I think it was probably 70s and 80s. And the materials, 20, 30 years later, started to all go at once. And so there was lots and lots of litigation threat. And so New Zealand set up 2 tracks, a legal track and a mediation track for homeowners to attempt to make themselves whole, thinking that most of them would use the litigation track. It didn't work out that way. The majority of the homeowners used the mediation track. And so my job at that time was to work with a number of mediators to get them quickly up to speed so that they could step in and help the homeowners and contractors and builders to resolve some pretty significant issues involving people's private homes. So you can imagine it's not only challenging regarding the finances in the building, but also the emotional end for the homeowners. So that's just one example of work that I've done in other countries. I've done a good variety of work, and it's all been fun with lots of cultural aspects to it. It's a fantastic career. I've learned a lot. I've met a lot of brilliant people and been a small part of helping people to resolve some pretty significant problems. So it's been really rewarding.
Gary Van Dorn, born in Cedar Rapids, Iowa in 1966. Well, I, of course, was educated in the Cedar Rapids school system starting in 1971 when I entered kindergarten. And that's where I met Mrs. Willoughby, Mrs. Doris Willoughby. She was my itinerant teacher. And I ended up going to the Iowa Braille and Sight-Saving School in Vinton, Iowa, where I graduated in 1985. I never learned to use a white cane until I was at the Iowa Commission for the Blind.
You went to Kirkwood Community College, and did you get a degree?
An AA in Educational Careers. And then I applied to UNI and to Iowa City. I wanted to be a teacher. And so I was accepted at Mount Mercy College in Cedar Rapids, which is a private 4-year school. And so I graduated with a bachelor's degree in history in 1991. And I just got to realizing, I don't really want to know if I want to teach. I thought about it over about a week and a half, and I realized no. And so I talked to Greg, and he suggested we perhaps look at applying for a government position. And he encouraged me to apply for the government because it's stable. They tend to do very good at hiring blind people. So I put in applications with the federal government for customer service rep at the Rock Island Arsenal, where I would work with people in the military and military retirees. And of course, I would have to move to Davenport if I got the job. And Lions World Services for the Blind came up. They rated me and offered a position. So I finished at Lions World, and that in itself was an experience and how self-advocacy works. Denver. I moved here. And I moved here knowing nobody, nobody except Mr. and Mrs. McGeorge and Julie Deedon, because I had met them at the 1987 convention in Phoenix. So when I moved here, it was an easy connection. So they were the only three people I knew. And from there, I ended up growing and meeting not only other blind people, but interestingly, other people. So I ended up forming connections into the LGBTQ community. Those ties are very strong and very deep. Moving to Denver was quite an experience, and it was nerve-wracking, but I did it.
Michelle Chacon. I was born in February of 1972 in a little town called Gallup, New Mexico. So I lost my vision when I was 6 years old.
You worked at the Colorado Center for 2 years teaching home management.
Before I went to the Colorado Center for the Blind, I was working at the Orientation Center in Alamogordo, New Mexico. 99, I had the opportunity to work an elementary program at the Colorado Center for the Blind, a summer program, and fell in love working with little kids, because before that it was all working with adults. And I felt like that's where I wanted to be. So I applied for a substitute position at the New Mexico School for the Blind and Visually Impaired preschool in Albuquerque, New Mexico. But they never really offered me a full-time position. So then in New Mexico, they call it an educational assistant. And I loved working with kids. And she told me, you know, you can have all this experience, but it's not going to do any good if you do not have a degree or a license in teaching. So I started back to school in 2003 at the University of New Mexico. Then I was able to get a position, special ed teacher on a waiver, at Chaparral Elementary in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And then the teacher of the visually impaired left. So I was contacted asking if I wanted to move into that position. I said, absolutely, that's where I wanted to be. I moved into that position and stayed there until 2007. And then I started looking for possibilities in Colorado with somebody pretty special in my life, John.
So, John Deaton had your heart.
He did. So looked for a job possibility out here and found one in Westminster, Colorado. So I became a teacher of the visually impaired and orientation mobility specialist in 2007. Between 2003 and 2008, I've completed one master's in special education at the University of New Mexico, started a second master's program at New Mexico State University, and transferred to the University of Northern Colorado, where I completed my second master's in special education with the emphasis in visual impairment and orientation and mobility. 2016 to 2020, I was working for the New Mexico School for the Blind and Visually Impaired as a mentor. I was working for the outreach department, and we were serving as mentors to individual teachers who are going through the New Mexico State University program to become teachers of the visually impaired or orientation and mobility specialists. So they were able to take their classes and get their internship done at the same time because we'd mentor them. From the second half of 2018 to 2020, I was flying back and forth between Denver and Albuquerque because I had a family situation, lost one of my daughters to cancer. So it was very, very hard. So we needed to come back home and be near the family. It was what I wanted to do. I loved the job. And so, but then I had to realize that, you know, it was getting to be taxing. It was getting to wear me down some. And I thought, I need to find something closer to home. So I was very, very fortunate and grateful to be able to find a position in Denver Public Schools where I am currently. So working and going to school and raising children.
My name is Marianne Migliorelli. I was born in 1970 in Schenectady, New York. I was born blind. I started working as a professional musician when I was 11 years old, and I worked with adult bands as a drummer. I played professionally and was collecting paychecks all the way through my senior year of high school. I went into the Business Enterprise Program for 12 years in New York, and I had my own facilities. And then I came out to Colorado and I helped manage other people's facilities for 7 more years. I moved to Boulder, and 4 months after I moved, I got laid off from my employment at a particular vending facility. And I was really trying to find more work. When I was applying for jobs, it was, where's your driver's license and where's your degree? If you didn't have a driver's license, you couldn't even get through the online application. To those things, my husband said to me, you know, why, instead of just kind of beating this dead horse, why don't you go get your degree? And so that's why I went and got a degree in business and hospitality, because that was the closest to what I really wanted to do. I wanted to work in hotels, and it took me a year of very diligent looking before I got a networking connection. It was actually from Blind Institute of Technology, from Mike Hess. And Mike met me at a state convention. He said, well, make sure you email me your resume, and I'm going to put it into the hands of a hotel that is interested in you. I worked for the Marriott Tech Center for a couple of years. And I moved to the Curtis Hotel, which was in downtown Denver. And I worked at the Curtis for another year and a half or 2 years. Up here in Boulder, there were two brand new hotels being built. It was the Embassy Suites and the Hilton Garden Inn. And I got hired to be on the opening team for those two hotels. Yes, when the pandemic started, my hotels shut down completely. And I was unemployed for 6 months. And I absolutely thank the Federation, because I saw a posting on Colorado Talk for customer service center representatives for Colorado Department of Labor and Employment to help with unemployment claims. By all of those skills that I had, I was able to move into a job working for the state. And now I'm on my second level of the job. It's a great job for somebody who constantly wants to ask why. My commute got way shorter. It used to be, I don't know, 15 minutes by car or something. And now it's like 30 seconds across my house.
Renee Anderson. I was born in 1964. In Omaha, Nebraska, at Offutt Air Force Base.
So you were blinded as an adult?
Adult. I was 27. We moved up to the mountains near Vail. I started working in the schools and later as an executive director for a nonprofit. I'm not doing that any longer. I've since moved and now live in southeastern Colorado. And I'm actually starting a new position tomorrow with Rocky Mountain Health Plans under United Health Group. They're bringing me on at an entry level, but they're moving me very quickly to the strategic planning team.
We should ask what Michelle's doing. Okay, so this these interviews occurred in August. Is that right, Mossam? Michelle? Is Michelle in the room? No, she's not here. Okay, so Michelle Chacon, what she didn't report on here is that she has a new job. I'm not even sure what the job title is. Julie, do you?
Well, she's a supervisor in the Denver Public School District, and she supervises blind and deaf teachers.
Educators.
For, we are also proud of Michelle for doing this. There's not any blind people that I know of that are in a supervisory position working with
okay. So, there you go.
If you noticed in the interviews that a lot of them went into careers and changed, and many of it was not because they didn't like their careers, although there was a little bit of that too, but it was that opportunities, once they got a job, opened up to find a job. I want to tell you that that has been the way that it has been ever since our original organization, the United Workers for the Blind, began in 1915 is when we have our first records. And a lot of those very early people understood what now the interviewees that you heard also understand is that you can't do it always by yourself, that you need somebody to give you a hand up as well. The first president that we have a lot of information about is Lute Wilcox. He became president in 1915. We had an earlier president of which I still don't know very much about. But Lute Wilcox was a blind guy who was born a little before the Civil War. And when the Civil War broke out, there was not a lot of educational opportunities for anybody, no matter what. He had weak eyes, but what did that mean? We don't really know what that means. There was no medical information about it. He began work in printing shops at age 8, and he worked his way up through the various jobs, learning just about everything in a printing company that there was. He became a reporter. He moved to New Mexico and was the editor of the Las Vegas Optic. Now, by this time, he had lost enough vision that he really didn't see people across the room that well. He didn't physically read that much. Why was he the editor of the newspaper? Well, the editor doesn't have to read the newspaper. They have to know what's going into it, comment on the editorials, write the editorials in some cases. He was noted for interviewing Billy the Kid. Now, he moved to Denver and began editing the Field and Farm magazine. And when you had a magazine that you were printing, you were usually printing that magazine as well. You did everything from the binding, the printing, the writing, to the advertising, the circulation. You did it all. He did that. He pretty much had very little vision at all by 1885. He married once he got up here to Denver. He became an active member of the Denver Press Association, and hello to you too. And he was part of, he was president of the Denver Press Association for a while. He had a lot of connections. What he also did was somehow through all of his travels, he became known to many blind organizations. And in 1900, he had 3 students from the New York Institute for the Blind in Batavia working at his plant, teaching them how to be newspaper men or to run a printing establishment of their own. So he already knew that it was important for blind guys to stick together. So when the United Workers for the Blind was formed in 1913, he was one of the early members of the organization. He helped with some of the legislation, and he was part of a team. This team consisted of people who were broommakers, who had no jobs at all, who was a teacher, we'll get to her in a second, and later on, legislators. And they all worked together, no matter what their class was, no matter what their status was as a blind person. Jenny Coward Jackson was the teacher of the bunch. Now, she had been blind since with an accident from a young age. And Jenny had gone to the School for the Blind as an older student, graduated, got involved in the very first organization that of blind people, and I am going to butcher the name of it, but it was the National Association of to Promote the Higher Education of the Blind, and a few other words in there. That organization was in the 1890s, and many folks from Kansas, Missouri, Iowa, Illinois, a lot of Midwestern folks had gotten together and said, we have to do something. Blind guys got to go to college or they're not going to get a job. Well, the organization turned into something else and something else and something else. The blind guys pretty much lost control of it. But Jenny came in the early 1900s to Colorado, and she brought that belief that you've got to stick together, you got to get an education no matter what, you got to get some blindness skills so that you can get a job that you can live off of and not live off of your family or off of charity. So she went to the legislature and she helped propose, her and a few other blind guys. There was actually another organization that had started, United Workers for the Blind, that lasted a couple of years, kind of fell apart when its leader moved to Oregon. But she was a part of that effort as well. And they tried to get legislation together to get a teacher for the blind that would travel across the state. Well, they got that, and the state allowed for one teacher of the blind to travel the entire state. And especially since it was going to be a woman, there was no need to have a really high salary. And also, I mean, how much can blind people want anyway? So there's a little bit of a stipend there to help pay for anything that you might need. But what was there to buy in Colorado? There was nothing to buy for blind guys in Colorado. There was no place to buy a slate and stylus. There was no place to buy any services. Jenny started out traveling around the state. She was married to one of the United Workers for the Blind members. Mr. Jackson was a minister, and he also sold brooms. Broom sales were a legitimate occupation, and there were a lot of blind guys that did pretty well off of broom sailing. They would go to door to door. So it's a profession that we today think of as demeaning, low class, you know, sheltered shop. And it was not necessarily connected with sheltered shops back at the turn of the century. And blind guys did do fairly well at selling brooms and making brooms. Jenny traveled the state. She would go to Grand Junction or Fort Collins or wherever, and she'd stay for a couple of weeks. Before she would arrive, she would send an article to the local paper, and it would say something to the effect that Jenny Coward Jackson is coming to town and start classes for those who are blind and want to learn techniques of blindness. And she would usually have a church basement or something where she would meet, and people would come 5 days a week, and she would start them off teaching them Braille, and she would start them off with some handicraft things to get them to use their hands again and explore. And she would leave them with Braille material to practice. The Matilda Ziegler magazine was one of them that she would leave, but she would buy Braille material and have it sent to her that she would leave with these people. And what they were supposed to do when she would come back in 4 to 6 months was they were supposed to round robin it around that whole group so that everybody would read everything that she left at least once. And they would learn to slate, and they were supposed to set up classes to follow up a few times a week with each other and encourage each other to work with the slates and styluses, and to keep up with their handicraft. She actually purchased for some of her students looms for rug weaving, or helped them purchase them with the money that she raised. Most of her salary actually went to paying for slates and styluses, Braille paper, Braille material, arts and crafts supplies. And one of the things she also did is after she had a group going for a year or two, she would make connections with a store. And when she would come back into town, these people who had been making all these craft items, they would have a week where they would sell their items at this furniture store or restaurant or whatever place had given them a window to display and sell their items. And these people started their own handicraft businesses, some of them. She was the educator of the bunch. And she helped teach some of the other members who had not had an opportunity to learn Braille. Other ones that I want to touch on quickly, there was a lady who had gone to the state school for the blind, and she wanted to be a music teacher. Charlton Harris was her name. She graduated. She went to college. She was fortunate enough to do that and get a teaching certificate, which only took like a year or two back then. The public schools would not hire her. They didn't want a blind teacher. She taught music out of her home, and she would go after students that would have connections to the education field, people in government, teaching their children, because she hoped that by demonstrating that she was a good music teacher, she could get a job in a public school. She was very good at her business, and she actually opened up a studio in downtown Denver, and then opened up a second studio in downtown Denver. She taught through her program. Later on, mostly she was the administrator, teaching only a few classes, because she had a lot of work to do with her PR and getting her students opportunities to play in front of the public, setting up performances for her classes, for her graduating classes, and helping her students find employment after they left her studios. Nobody would find her a job, but she was pretty good at finding other people's jobs. She was one of the long-standing members of the organization. If you read about her in our minutes later on, you're looking for Mrs. Richardson. She got married to a blind piano tuner in the organization who did quite well. In fact, her husband traveled out to San Francisco many times. A well-known pianist, who I never heard of, but did several performances here in Denver. And her husband tuned his piano to such a degree that he actually would send for her husband to travel to California, where he did many of his, he was from California and did many of his performances out there. And he would send for him several times to go out and tune his pianos for him, paid his expenses to do that. He was that good of a piano tuner. So we had Charlton, who was helping other blind women to go to college, realize that college was an opportunity, and helping them set themselves up in business. She had a couple of her friends who she helped through her studios for piano playing and so on, but most of them didn't turn out a career in music like Charlton did. Another two people I want to just quickly mention, because we've got one more audio that we want to play and ask some and have you guys ask some questions. But we had another person who was found by Jenny Coward Jackson, who was an attorney from Aspen, and he had gone blind later in life. He was a successful lawyer. He had a lot of money, and he tried to buy services for the blind so that he could continue to be a lawyer. And he had all this money he was willing to spend, and there was nothing to spend it on in Colorado. So what did he do? After meeting Jenny and realizing there's life after blindness, he decided that he was going to the state legislature, and he was going to change the situation for the next blind people coming along. So he became a state representative, and his name was James Downing. He was from Aspen. He joined the United Workers for the Blind, and together with Elias M. Ammons, I'll get to him in a second, and Lute and Jenny and a few others, They wrote the very first pieces of substantial legislation that would provide for educational opportunities and for a pension, although I don't believe they called it a pension. Pension was a bad word at the time. But the idea was that there would be a statewide subsidy for blind people to live off of if they qualified for it. Now, the reason for that is you could live in one county and you might get $2 for 6 months, $2 a month for 6 months, and then the county would say, now you got to go and take care of yourself because we're not going to pay you anymore. Where the neighboring county, you can maybe get $10 a month and you only had to petition to the county board once a year. So there was no standardization and they wanted to standardize all of this. Elias Ammons and James Downing, who is currently seating as a state rep, wrote this legislation. They shuffled it through the state legislature and it passed and made a big difference for a few years. Elias M. Ammons was an interesting man for me to research because he was a much older man at this time and had actually been our governor from 1913 to 1915. We had a blind governor. He had been blind his adult life. They didn't think of it as blind at that time because if you could see enough to get around, say, this hotel without bumping into anybody, you were okay. And if you couldn't read anything, well, you just faked it for 42 bars or something like that. He was a state representative in 1890. His daughter and his wife did much of his reading through his career from then on. He was a state senator. And the neat thing about him as a state senator was that he was speaker and he needed to read a lot more than his wife and his daughter could keep up with. And without any fanfare or hoo-ha back and forth, they just said, well, we'll just give the senator, Senator Ammons, an assistant. This was the first time that had ever been done. You know, we have had accommodations in the past, but we didn't think of them as accommodations in the past. Nobody else did. It was just helping each other out so they could be the best that they could be. We probably should go back to that idea, but that's a whole nother speech. These people all realized this would be what I would call our core group of people. These people all realized that if you did not join together and pull together, because getting that first piece of legislation passed didn't mean that you just had two great guys that were writing it because they knew all about legislation. You had Jenny Coward Jackson going around the state, getting all of these community groups to sign letters or to put into their local papers little ads saying, we support the bill for the blind. You had Lute Wilcox pulling the strings for the newspapers. He went to the Denver Press Association and through his contacts contacted newspapers all across the state asking them to run articles that some of our members had written and said, please put these in your paper, and that happened. So we have all these people together who are working together and putting out a lot of effort that is all coordinated and made that all happen. Now, what brought it a lot of that down was a few years later, a blind guy was put into the state house by the School for the Blind, supported by the American Foundation for the Blind, and put in legislation that pretty much neutered everything that had been done and put up a commission for the blind that was controlled by sighted people. So it took many years to fight and get that all back. So, you know, all that hard work was gone within 18 months. But I also want to tell you that there was another man that I will be writing about in my Blind History Lady emails that'll be coming out probably sometime next spring. And his name was Robert Derry. This is a guy who owes his life to blindness. Had he not been blind, he would have probably been shot by a sheriff or, you know, killed in some whatever nasty deed he had thought he was going to get into or whatever. By the time he was in his early 20s, he was already suspected of murdering 5 people. And he was wanted in Arkansas for murder. And so 2 sheriffs from Colorado captured him. Now, he was wanted in their county for murder, too. But those guys were volunteer sheriffs. Arkansas was paying. They wanted him back. They were paying for money. So these guys took him, they were taking him down to Arkansas, and he escaped. Now, somewhere along the line, they did get him back to Arkansas. It was a hung jury, so he didn't serve any jail time. Comes back to Colorado, and he's marching in a military parade, and people are throwing rocks, and they hit him in the face, and he's blinded. Now, what do you do as a blind guy? Well, he tried getting married to a sighted lady who would take care of him. Didn't work out. She didn't want to have anything to do with this helpless bum. So he goes into business in a tobacco store. They found this abandoned store, and these 2 guys, for real low rent, set up selling cigars. Well, the other guy didn't want to do it for long, and he thought, well, you know, I didn't do too bad, so I'll just keep selling cigars, and I can't afford the store, so I'll just sell them door to door. That didn't work out too bad. So he started taking the train and going to the next town and the next town. Pretty soon he had his own store, and he hired somebody to work in that store. And it turned out that she actually married him later on. But he then started buying tobacco, making his own brand of cigars and so on. When he passed away back in the 1930s, he had one of the largest tobacco businesses in the southern part of the state. But what is important about this guy is he did not associate with blind people. So when he was boarding a train, he was coming from Salida going to Denver, and you have to switch trains, and it was late in the evening, and the porters were taking people by lantern to their next train and so on. He had asked for help. They bring him to the next train. The porter says, here, you know, get on the train. Now, the porters, what they usually did at that time was, in the dark, they would follow the patron up the stairs with their lantern so the patron could see where they're going and help them find their seat in the car. Well, they didn't do that, and they had left a gate open on the top of the platform, and Derry fell off the other side. So it wasn't that bad of an injury. He lost about a week's work. He thought that the railroad should compensate him because they had not followed their protocol, and he lost pay. Now, had he been cited, they probably would have handed him a 25 bucks, and this whole thing would have gone away. But what they did was they went to, they said, well, no, we're not going to pay because you're a blind guy. And Derry takes him to court. And they come in and say, well, look, blind people should not be riding the trains by themselves. Everybody knows that. They should have someone taking care of them on the train. Everybody knows that. And besides, he didn't even pay for a ticket because blind guys don't have to pay for their tickets on the railroad. That incensed Derry because he not only paid for his ticket, but he paid for a first-class sleeping car. So now his dander is up. Did he reach out to blind guys to help? No. Anyway, he wins that first suit. The railroad's appealed. They get a second case. And again, the railroads, now they've changed their tunes. I mean, it's obvious that he, you know, when he bought his ticket, somebody else bought it, so therefore the railroads didn't know. And if you pay for a half fare ticket or you have an attendant with you at one time or another, then you're admitting that you are incapable of handling yourself, and they believe that he had done that. So therefore, he already told the railroads that he was not capable as a blind person. Therefore, if he's riding at any other time unescorted, the burden isn't on them. Derry said, this has nothing to do with blindness. This has everything to do with your policies. And the courts deliberated. They found in favor of Derry, $15,000, by the way. And the railroads appealed. So they take it to the Supreme Court. Now, this has gone on for several years by now. And it's a principle, because if the railroads are able to win, and Derry has to travel with a sighted person to take care of him, what does that say to his clients? This is what his concern was. What does that say to my clients? Are they going to start talking to that sighted person, to my assistant? Are they going to think less of me as a merchant? Are they going to start thinking of me as the blind cigar salesman rather than the tobacco salesman? Big difference. So he needed to win. So the Supreme Court comes up. Now the tobacco industry, the railroad has decided that, okay, maybe they better play this a little bit different. So they're starting to say, well, you know, it's right, but it's still his own fault because he walked off of the platform. They escorted him like he had said, and they helped him like he'd said, but that he didn't listen. He went off of the side. Now, in the earlier cases, there were other people from the train who he did not know, who testified on his behalf that the porter stayed at the bottom of the stairs and walked away, just letting Derry go up the stairs by himself. Again, he hammered on the fact that they didn't follow their protocol, they didn't follow their policies, and he had done his homework, and he finally won. And if you're looking for the case in Colorado history, you don't look for a blind guy, because there's hardly any mention of his blindness when it comes to the court stuff. Derry made sure of that. But what he did, and he knew this too, even though he wouldn't associate with a lot of other blind guys, but he knew that if he lost and he had to travel with an attendant, so would every other blind person, and that would change your opportunities for employment, that would change your ability to travel freely, that would change the amount of travel that you would be able to do, because somebody could easily refuse to allow you an option to travel, because you know you're getting one ticket for free, so if they've got more paying passengers, you don't go on the train. That makes a big difference. So these are the kind of people that we had as our ancestors here in Colorado. And those people are the people who have tried hard to build our laws and change the lives for all of us. But as you can tell, it has to be every generation. Once we stop, we don't focus on that community. Again, we have to start all over, be an example again, even though there have been plenty before. But one of the things that we can do with our history, if we know it, is that we can go into the employer and say, look, there's already been a blind stockbroker here in Colorado. We've already had blind people who are management in hotels. We've already had blind people who have been governor. We have one more audio file for you, and I'm going to have Dan introduce that.
This next collection is called NFB in My Life. There's no lawyers. Our cases, but a lot of it has to do with, Peggy asked a lot of questions like who are your mentors, you know, who are, what did you, what have you learned in the NFP, and, you know, what do you see for the future? And so there is, it's like a montage of a lot of those kinds of things. You'll hear some new voices from the interviews, and a lot of it has to do with people.
Michael Massey.
When did you first learn about the National Federation of the Blind?
Oh, about 1969. Somehow I got signed up and got the Braille monitor. I don't know how that got started. Because, see, I joined the local chapter in 1970. Mm-hmm. So I was 15 and I was a board member, actually. Then became president for a little bit in the early 2000s.
What kind of activities had the Pueblo chapter done that you took part in?
Well, a couple of things. We did some Meet the Blind Munson, they called it. One of the things we did was cane races at one of the local stores that made the Braille monitor.
When was your first state convention?
1980 in Greeley, Colorado.
What impressed you about the national conventions?
I just couldn't believe how all those people are moving around, just getting where they needed to go. The dogs and the canes and all of that commotion. This is amazing. People get where they're going.
Is there anything that you've learned from the Federation that has helped you in your life?
Just learn to stick up for yourself and advocate for yourself. What I learned is sometimes you have to. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a Federation or certain things I wouldn't have been able to stand up to do. I got to vote independently. It was so nice to vote at home and do it right there. Didn't have to worry about some election judge not being able to hear. And the machine's not working. I've even, at one point, had to be in a voting machine. I had to get tech support called, and it caused a line to build up. And I didn't like it. I said, well, I'm going to vote, by golly, and I did in 2008.
And that was an accessible voting machine.
Yes.
Do you recall voting previous, before there was any accessibility?
Yes, and having to use election judges to help me and grab the pen and mark the holes in the ballot that was supposed to be marked. Hope to God I was marking the right ones. And I sure felt uncomfortable having to tell election judges where my vote is, what I was voting for. I didn't like that at all. But yeah, before, when I was, my first vote in 1974. And I've been voting ever since, and will vote till the day I die. And yes, I like it, yes, because I can vote in private. Nobody knows how I'm voting unless I tell them. Otherwise, I vote how I vote, and nobody knows. It's what I like.
Alice, George, I know I first became involved in early 80s, about 81, but I did know about the National Federation of the Blind before then. Certainly not during college days, not during working days. I joined the Loveland chapter. I was living in Loveland at that time. Diane McGeorge came up to organize a chapter in Loveland about 1980. Then I joined and became involved around 1981. I was president most of the time, most of the years. Most of the members in the group were older. The older people who were past in working age. They were more interested in how to remain independent in their own homes. Brought in lots of resources and had presentations to present to them and assist them getting those resources and staying independent. I have learned a tremendous amount about many, many different things. I think one of the most valuable things that I have learned or that has helped me the most is how to advocate. Advocate for both myself and for others. Just to be able to speak up and say, this is what works best for me, or this is what I need, and this is why. For many years, I did not do that. Well, you know, in college days, I didn't know there was such a thing as vocational rehabilitation or other services out there for blind people. And so it's like, you can't ask for what you don't know about. But I've learned so much about the various resources that's available for blind people, what the laws are, what we are entitled to, And as a result, I really have learned how to become an advocate. The National Federation of the Blind is a wonderful organization for any blind person or someone losing their vision. It really does promote one's self-esteem. It helps people see what can be done. There's so many wonderful mentors to work hard, to do what they do and be where they are. And I think they're just wonderful mentors to show us what can be done and what we all can do. It's just the positive attitude and the confidence that's built among people who are in a community of others experiencing the same things. It's just a powerful movement.
Gary Van Dorn, one of the things I've always respected about the McGeorgie, because they were doing things in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, that we take for granted. I purchased my condominium in 1994, and I started attending board meetings. I wanted to be involved in my community. And the management company was like, oh my goodness, they freaked out because they found out I was blind and what it would do to our insurance. One of the members on the board spoke up clearly, and he says, it will not affect our insurance. You will not tell them he's blind. Gary will own this association and he will own your business. And they went, excuse me. He says, I sold insurance for years. I was involved in the insurance lobby in Colorado, and I'll be, quote, damned, unquote, if I'm going to tangle with Diane and Ray McGeorge ever again. And he told me the story later, is that when they were running an insurance bill, he was on the other side of the bill, trying to lobby the legislature saying, no blind people are a risk. Ray McGeorge did something, and this is something else I've also learned from the Federation. Make friends with the politicians. Show them what blind people are, that we're everyday people. And he remembers making friends with Diane and Ray and going to their home with his wife. And he said it wasn't about blindness. It was about friendship. And he said he had to admit he was surprised when Ray would fire up the grill and cook hamburgers. But he did it. And he said that so impressed him, he stopped lobbying so hard and the bill got passed. But that shows how the Federation actually works. Without realizing it, Diane and Ray had done the battle, so I did not have to do the battle about the insurance. It had already been won 20 years before. We're starting to make strides in accepting blind people for who we are as human beings. We're not always going to be straight white dudes or straight white ladies or Christians. We're going to be of color. We're going to be gay or transsexual. We're not always going to be people who are interested in going on to college. We represent society. But I think our challenges that we have in the Federation are challenges we have in society. The Federation will struggle. But I think what unites us is blindness.
Renee Anderson. When I lived in Avon, my husband and I, we would go swimming about 3 or 4 times a week. And this one time we were at the pool and this woman walked up to me and she said, hi, my husband is blind and he's over here. We'd love to meet you. And I'm like, oh, okay. I'm friendly. I'd like to meet people. Well, it was Jim and Susie Gashel. We became good friends and, have barbecues at each other's house and stuff. And he's like, you want to come be a part of the NFB? And I'm like, are you kidding? No. And I explained to him and he goes, okay, they're not going to take your dog away. And he said, it's different. This one's on the phone. I'll try it. I love going to do the legislation stuff. I loved going down to the Capitol building it's not scary. And I remember the second time I went to the Capitol, I was with a group, and I think there were four of us, maybe five of us, and the others hadn't ever done it. And I'm like, oh, this is a piece of cake. This is what we do. Let's just find the rooms, you know? And so we found what we needed to do. And I think it's great camaraderie. It's great standing for what we believe in.
What sort of things have you learned from your involvement in the Federation?
I'm not powerless. I can do things, and it doesn't mean that I'm not fearless. Sometimes there is fear there, but it's not going to hold me down. You know, I'm going to be able to go do something that I might be uncomfortable doing. It was in Fort Collins. It was a state convention. They were having a tactile art. And I'm like, what is this? And I said, you know, I used to be an artist. And I said, I didn't think I could do this again. You know, how can someone do art if they're blind other than crafts kind of thing? Okay. That was my, how do you do this? So I went just wanting to figure this out. And I was just like, oh my gosh, I can do art again. We sat at these tables and everybody was given all these different things. And I was like drawing and just, I was loving it. I was having so much fun. And Julie came over and she goes, are you having fun? I said, Julie, you have no idea what I'm experiencing right now. And I said, you know, I used to be an artist. And I said, I didn't think I could do this again. I feel like the NFB has opened up a lot of things for me in the sense of understanding things better and realizing that I do have a voice. The more we learn about each other, the more we see what we need to do and how we can help each other. And that's what I think is great about this organization, because we are people that act outside the box. I think that's important, because none of us fit in the same blind box. We don't. We're all different in so many different facets of the world.
John Deedon.
When did you first learn of the National Federation of the Blind?
I had heard about it before, but my sister, who is blind, who's 2 years older than me, Julie had gotten involved in it. She was going to the University of Colorado. And she said, hey, John, I met this really neat group of people, and you should really check into the National Federation of the Blind. I think you would like it. And so I did. That's when I actually bought my first cane. I should have been using one long, long before, but I didn't. I didn't even want people to really know that I was blind. But the only one I was fooling was myself. Everybody knew I was blind. But anyway, it made me feel good to buy a cane and start using a cane and being totally independent and knowing that people just knew that I was blind and I didn't have to fake it anymore. And I love that feeling. I really did. I remember the first day when I got a cane and I started using it, and I thought, wow, this is really neat. And I stayed up in Boulder that night with my sister and her husband at the time. And I decided I was going to go out, and I couldn't see at night. I'd never really been able to see at night. That's where my vision was. I had a lot more day vision. Now I don't really have any at all. I went out at night with my cane, went to a bar, and I call it the best beer I've ever drank, because I went there by myself and I knew I could find places and I knew I could travel by myself independently with that cane, and I did it. I loved it. I've learned that it's okay to be a blind person, and I've learned to have, self-confidence. In the NFB, it's given me that. And that's a lot right there in life to me, because if you don't have that, you could make it, but it's a lot easier when you have it. I've learned to be a self-advocate and driven, which is important too to me. I mean, if I have a goal, I want to ascertain it. First and foremost, in my mind, I go for it. And I think the NFB has taught me that. The NFB really actually gave me my career. I wasn't planning on becoming a stockbroker or being in the securities industry. Not at all. Mainly to see blind people be successful is the big thing for me. I mean, that's really what I want. Mm-hmm. I want people to be employed, have a job, and have a life, live on their own, you know, own their own home, everything that a normal person has. And that's what I want for blind people, because there's no reason why they can't. There isn't. As long as you have proper training and everything, and you are a member of the NFB, I think it helps out a lot. I really believe that from the bottom of my heart. I just have lived it, so I know what the NFB does for me.
Judy Modest Dixon. I probably was aware of it as a child, because I know Diane McGeorge, and she and my mother met when I was a baby in my mother's dentist office, which was Diane's dentist office. And my mother saw her there and just took the opportunity to introduce herself and started asking questions. And so they became friends. And as I grew older, she and I became friends. I knew her husband, Ray. Amazing people and amazing role models. So I knew that they were involved in this organization. I didn't really settle down into the NFB until I had just finished my bachelor's program. And I went to a couple of meetings in Denver, and I was very impressed by the people that were in attendance and how independent they were and how smart they were. And I was invited out of the blue to attend the national convention in New Orleans. And I was thrilled and I was fearful, and it was a great experience. And that's kind of what launched it. I met a number of blind people from around the country that had good careers, good jobs, were smart, took chances, had to break down barriers. And I lapped all of that up, thinking that, you know, if they could do it, I could certainly try. I was maybe more impressed by a man who was about twice my age. I met him a couple of years later at the March on Washington, I believe it was. He did not have an education, and he was working in a sheltered workshop. And he and his wife had several children, and they were making next to nothing, living on next to nothing, hard life. He was very dedicated to the Federation, and he couldn't initially figure out why we would want to close down sheltered workshops, because he knew that he and his family would starve to death. And I remember sitting quietly while a couple of our members from the national office sat with him for long periods of time and explained how it would work and how he would be okay and how he would make a living. And I was so impressed with their dedication and patience. I would hope, given that our unemployment rate among blind people is still just so unacceptably high, I would hope that we would double down on our efforts to do more regarding employment, finding people jobs at all levels. Because that's the key to independence, right? That it's the primary key to independence. So that's what I would hope for more of. I think the NFE is very relevant. There's always going to be a lot to do, especially as technology advances, and as long as the unemployment rate is as high as it is. We really have to celebrate what this organization does for every blind person, whether they pay dues or not. See if we can get more of those non-dues payers to step up.
Thank God for the NFB.
Okay. We're going to do a little Q&A here. So can I have a volunteer to take around this microphone so that we can hear people talking? Does somebody want to take this microphone around? Who's me?
Duncan.
Okay. Duncan. Dunkin' Donuts. Mm.
No, we're selling chocolate, not donuts.
All right. Who has some questions that they would like to ask about our history or comments that you'd like to make today about today's presentation?
Oh, somebody back here.
Mike is coming. Duncan's coming.
I'm coming with a mic. Here you go.
Hi, everyone. Peggy, I just had a question for you. What made you interested in the historical aspects of the Federation and the United Workers? I think it's United Workers Union for the Blind.
Well, I have been very interested in blind history for many years. Because I was just so shocked. I grew up in the blind community, and I thought I knew it all. You know how young people are. And discovered that I knew very, very little about the blind community. And so I had a few questions, and when I found the answers to those few questions, it turned out those, like, say, five questions turned into 25 questions. And then when I answered those 25, I had 425 questions because we have such a rich history. So when I found out from Julie Hunter that there were these old records in the basement, I wanted at them. And, of course, most of them were in handwriting and bad shape. So we started the project to unlock those documents, get them transcribed, and so on. And that's how I got interested in them.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Absolutely, the mic is coming. Dick Duncan is coming with the mic for you, Miss Diane.
Thank you so much. This has been so wonderful. Brought back lots of memories of what has become of some of those people that were interviewed. Peggy, I don't know how you did all that, but you could do anything, so I'm not surprised. If you haven't read Cornerstones, that's by Julie Hunter and Peggy Chong. It's just a wonderful book. It's about our history and goes way back. Anyway, I do can tell you a little bit. Judy Dixon has become extremely successful. She is a mediator all over the world. Seriously, she travels all over, and she's tremendous. And John Deaton, God bless John, he says, I'm one of your kids. You may be ashamed of me. I could never be ashamed of any of my kids. He's a wonderful guy. He's had a lot of serious health issues, and I'm sorry about that. But we still keep in touch. I doubt that he's well enough to come this weekend, but I'd love it if he could. I know that if he can, he'll be here. But what a wonderful job you did with this, Peggy. I just cannot tell you what. It was so great talking about how Judy's mother, Judy Dixon's mother and I met. I was in the dentist's office. That's where I was. And she came over to me and she said, I'd like to meet you. And she told me her name. Ruby was her first name. And she said, I have two blind children. And I'd love it if you would meet them. And of course I said, absolutely. Bring them over or Ray and I will come over to your house, whatever is convenient. So, let me see. They came over to our house, and one of the cutest stories Judy ever told me, she was so little, and we were pointing out how you could tell where things were by just listening, and we said, see, you can hear the refrigerator. So you follow, can just hear that sound, and you know that's where the refrigerator is. And Judy said to me later, she was a little bitty kid, and she said, Ray walked out to demonstrate, and he stepped on my finger, and I didn't want to say anything. So those are just some of the wonderful memories that this provided for me. Thank you, Peggy. That was a great job.
And Cornerstones will be selling at the exhibit table as long as the quantities brought down here for this weekend last for $15 a copy, print or braille, by the way. So you can stop by the table and get that. One other little memory that I remember Judy Dixon told me was that Diane also made an impression because when Diane came to her house, she sat in one of her little chairs and she fit. Diane fit. Not other, a lot of other adults did. Are there any other questions?
Yes. Okay. The acoustics in this room suck, and it shouldn't even be used. But since you have to use it, it's very, very important that you take the time to make people hold the microphone very, very close. And that makes them sound better. And no matter how profound and how hard people work, it doesn't make a bit of difference if you can't understand them.
That is, I'll try and eat this microphone. I talk with my hands, and I know it back and forth at times.
Yeah, even holding the microphone you're using closer makes a huge, huge difference from on. You can't understand it to normal.
Thank you. We'll keep that in mind. Who's the next person?
I'll run behind you. Good evening, everybody. My name is Sarai Alvarado. And this is my first time. And I'm loving it. I have retinitis pigmentosa. I still have vision, but it's diminishing slowly, which is making me sad, but with the help of everybody here and at CCB, Duncan, Diane, everybody, you guys are making me very strong and confident and be able to move on, because that's just part of life. And I also want to say, I brought my sister, my sister Sylvia, she has Parkinson, but I brought her because in my family, the vision thing, it runs in our family a lot. A lot of cousins, a lot of people. But in my immediate family, there's like issues about bullying people like myself and other family members. And I invited her to come with me because when we go back home to Denver, you know, she can also help me to kind of educate my family a little bit better to don't be so mean, don't be such a bully. You know, just because I can't see right does not mean I'm any different than anybody else. I'm not handicapped. I'm handicapable. I just do things a little bit more different than you, but I still get it done. And that's what I want them to understand. And that's why I am here. And thank you. And thanks to the NFB because they helped me out a lot.
And welcome to your first convention. I'm sure this won't be your last. Thank you. Anyone else who's got some questions? Yes, Mr. Chong, I hear you. He's telling me about the time. And we do have to cut this off a little bit, but we started late, so I just want to have, you know, if people have some questions, you know, we were going to have to give this over to the next session in just a bit. But I'll take another question or two.
I'm not seeing anybody's hand.
Okay. One question coming up.
There's a question coming up.
And you are?
I'm waiting for Mike.
Oh, I should have known. Uh-huh.
Here you go.
I could hear her, so I
had
to be someone with a loud voice.
Yes, I could take care of that in this room, but I will not be rude about it as much as would be tempting. I am Marianne Migliorelli, and I just want to say for those who put time and effort into this presentation, when Peggy did these interviews, she said, oh, we're going to sit, we're going to talk maybe half an hour. And all of us just kind of laughed because we knew for a fact that we, by the time we were talking and we would be doing things, it would be way longer. And the time and effort that went into putting this presentation together was significant. Many, many days, much time of doing the interviews, culling the interviews. What we heard in this room today that were audio clips was probably not even a half an hour. That was probably culled from probably 30 or 40 hours worth of work. So just so you know, our history is important enough for people to take serious time to make it count. So never think you've learned it all. Never think that any of us know it all, because we don't. And take your time to learn, because you don't know, sitting in this room, who you will meet later who might want to know how to do a thing that one of our ancestors has done. So just think about that when you're here. This is our opening session and so on. But this is an amazing start to understanding who we are as a people. We are all people. And sometimes I think we forget that. And thank you to Peggy and Dan and Mike and all those who took the time to cull through all of that material to create something this amazing for today.
Thank you. Well, and I'm going to be around, and Julie Hunter, I don't think she's in the room here today. Oh, she is too. Okay, there's Julie.
Hello. There's Julie.
To get people to come to the October 14th event that we had at the Colorado Center for the Blind, I said, didn't you ever wonder what Julie Hunter looked like on the other end of the keyboard? She had to work with our over 100 volunteers who took thousands and thousands of hours to do all of this stuff. And you'll hear more about that this weekend, too. But I'm going to close this because we have to transfer this room over to the next group. I do have a little bit of my Blind History Lady handouts here, and I do have some of my book, Don Mahoney, Television Star, that you can also get on BARD. But if you want a print copy, I'll even autograph it for you. I have that up here as well. And I will be glad to put you on my email list, because, of course, now that we are getting through some of these, we're going to have a lot more Coloradans in my Blind History Lady emails that I send out once a month. And we already did Elias M. Ammons, but, you know, there's a lot more to come. So thank you, everybody, for being here.